My name is Andrew Stewart, and I am a member of the Rhode Island Media Cooperative. 2016 has proven to be one of the most eventful years in recent memory. One element that is particularly taking up a substantial level of interest is the issue of minority rights. In a year where groups like Black Lives Matter have been making headlines on a weekly basis, it seems that a great level of political activity and attention is being paid Black and Brown people and their votes during this election. In order to better understand this group, I have spent the past year talking with voters across America, asking them about both the election and what they hope to hear talked about the day after they cast their ballot. We now present to you the results of those conversations. Today, we will hear from two women who are mothers and educators within minority communities. Marta Martinez is an author and historian of the Rhode Island Latinx community.
Right now, I'm the director of an organization called Rhode Island Latino Arts, and we promote the cultures of Latin America, the art, the history, the heritage, the cultures.
Mm-hmm. So what are you seeing as a parent, an educator, and somebody who has worked in that field over the year that has been the election year, I guess?
I'm seeing a lot of divide among the two parties, unfortunately, and I'm also seeing a lot of fear. I'm hearing about a lot of fear. I'm, you know, talking broadly, not so much from a local perspective. I live in Rhode Island now, but I grew up in the Southwest in a border city. Mm-hmm. Where the Mexican community is, it's part of it's part of life to see Mexicans work in the U.S. and cross over into the border. And I do travel there a lot, and I always approach things in that perspective where the Latino community is a big part of the American history, and people forget that the United States actually began as a part of Mexico. And Latinos are very ingrained in that, not only the national history, but in the local history. And there's been some fear from people living in border cities. And in looking at it from a Rhode Island perspective, there are Latinos here who are immigrants, who are recent immigrants, who seem to have some fear about what's been happening with particularly the Republican candidate talking about deporting everybody immediately after he's elected. So fear is one thing.
Okay. So have you seen a lot more pronounced xenophobia in the public?
I think it's pronounced. I think it's always been there.
Right.
I've felt it in a lot of the work I do, because I also work as I've been working as a community advocate in the Latino community, and it's always been there. People were always either never brought it up, the fact how they felt about Latinos, or they were very polite for some reason, but now it just seems like they have license to talk openly and to tell you exactly how they feel. And, you know, in a way that's good to know who you're standing next to, because you could be standing next to somebody who could tomorrow turn on you. If you don't know that, but now you're starting to know what people really are like out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that's good or not. It's frightening,
you know,
how much xenophobia, how much hate is out there.
Yeah. So, are there phenomena you see coming up in Providence or the wider, greater Providence community that are not being talked about, not focused around just immigration, like you were saying before? What are issues that you think really should be focused on, like economics,
right,
education?
I think Latinos in particular, as you know, they're the largest and the fastest growing group, ethnic group in the United States, and Rhode Island reflects that. And many of the people who are registered to vote and who are going to go out to vote, they do care about immigration, just like myself. It's a very important topic to me. But I also care about economics, jobs, health care,
Yeah.
Education, I think education is very important. That's at the top of my list, because if without an education, I mean, education is key to success.
Right.
To jobs, to getting where you are. So those are the most important topics that are being focused on and are being discussed among Latinos. And I believe that many of them are like myself. They do believe that immigration is important, but it's not at the top of their list.
Right. So what are the efforts going on in outreach towards millennials that are significant, you think?
The millennials, there's a lot of work being done to make sure that they're registered to vote. If they're not registered, there's effort being made to make sure they are. Those who are registered are going out to educate non-Latinos about what I just mentioned, the fact that we are part of the United States fabric. We are, you know, many of them were born in Rhode Island. They are children of immigrants, but they were born here, and they are the future of the country. And so they very well could be the next, you know, the future president could be a Latino. And the way the country is going as far as numbers, it could happen more than we realize.
Rhode Island is, for all intents and purposes, a single-party state. And there's a rather conservative wing, and there's a more liberal wing within the Democratic Party itself. What are the what are your impressions about what's been developing on the local level over the last year? Because there is a Latino political establishment located there.
Yeah, the Latino community, that's what I just mentioned. That's what they've been working on, is making sure that candidates, first of all, don't ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
They interview all candidates and the main reason is they do have an endorsement process where they interview candidates and at the end they endorse them. But I think the main campaign is to just let them know that there is a party, a Latino PAC, and they take the opportunity to educate them about what I just said, mm-hmm. the issues that are important to Latinos. So an endorsement from the PAC, from the real PAC, is important, but I think more importantly, it's a venue for us to educate non-Latinos and to also single out those who we perhaps want to talk about, tell Latinos they should vote for as well.
Right. In terms of Providence, it's got a Latino mayor, it's got a very significant Latino student population that is not prosperous in terms of the economic ladder. It's still in the lower tranches of the economy. What do you think the things need to be talked about after the election to help improve their education, their welfare as children, those sorts of things?
I think working with the Latino families, whether they're here most immigrants who come here, whether they're Latinos or not, their dream is to become U.S. citizens. Most people who leave their country, they always say it's temporary and that they will go back, but that just never happens. It's never the case. It's hard to go back home no matter where you're from. And so the goal is to, I'm hoping that what happens after the elections, that there is immigration reform, that we actually look at that. We look at the people who've been here for many years and as I said, for all intents and purposes, are American. And to give them that path to citizenship and you know, those who have been contributing to the economy, working and paying taxes. And I think that, you know, even though immigration isn't the number one issue, I really do think that that's a big barrier to what's happening among the Latinos and immigrants in the country.
So one of the issues that's been kind of prominent locally is the issue around licensing of undocumented people, and it's very contentious. What are your feelings on that just issue being in the news and how it evolves and those emotions and feelings it brings up in the press and the wider population?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, bringing up xenophobia, people are just they're afraid to, mm-hmm. of immigrants to take, you know, I've talked to people that who said that they'll take our jobs away, or I mean, that's the main thing, is how they affect the economy. But I think as long as they're here and they are working and they are paying taxes and they are living here, that and they're driving to work, that they should be allowed to have a driver's license while they're waiting for their citizenship. As I said, most people who come here, they do want to become citizens, and they're working at it. And while they're waiting for their papers, if they could just feel that they're, you know, mm-hmm. they're driving legally, that I think that's important, that we should let them do that. I'm not sure people understand that. They're afraid of immigrants, and I've had many discussions with this, with legislators and others, and they just don't really understand what the whole immigration process is. You can't just walk into a room and say, I want my papers, and you get them. It depends on where you're from. It's a long process. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, you have a bit of experience in education, and one of the policy positions advocated by the NAACP this year was a moratorium on charter schools, and we have charters in Latino neighborhoods across the state, and then also the potential expansion of Achievement First in Providence. There's a very vigorous dialogue around that. I'm just curious what your feelings are on charters and that sort of education, because there's a concern that it might be the recreation of, you know, two education systems that might not be separated equal.
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed on charter schools, because I really do see a positive side of them. If parents aren't going to get, if the public schools aren't able to provide what they were meant to provide,
mm-hmm.
And there are kids who are sitting there. I mean, my own kids really could have done better than the public schools. But at the same time, I really do see a strong need to fix the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be I don't think it's so much from a local level, because what happens in the local level is really dictated from the federal government. So there has to be change in the way education is funded, the way dollars are distributed, and what is expected out of the teachers in the local schools. I'm against having teachers test all the testing that happens.
Yeah.
It stresses kids, it stresses families, it stresses schools, it stresses teachers. So there's got to be a different way to deal with that. And I just really think that we need to focus on the public schools and what needs to change there to make them better, that without giving so much attention to the charter schools and the funding.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I think is a major driver behind the expansion of charter schools in Rhode Island is there's, at least for some people who don't know clearly what's going on, maybe an impression that it's a public version of how parochial schools were for another generation.
Why wouldn't I just go run on the treadmill?
That it's a public version of the parochial schools, is that what you said?
Yeah, it's taking on kind of the role that for my parents' generation and my generation, the Catholic schools had.
Right, or you know, private schools. There is people believe that. I think the way they're portrayed, you know, there's the other side too. There's teachers that I've talked to that also feel that they're not necessarily, they feel so bound with what's happening in the public schools, that even the teachers, the good teachers, leave the public schools to go teach in charter schools because there's more flexibility. So parents believe there's more flexibility, teachers feel there's more flexibility in the way the curriculum is provided, and you're not bound by all the common core that the federal government imposes on everybody. And so, yeah, there's I just you know, bottom line is I think we really need to look at the public schools and fix them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there any other points you think are worth discussing or talking about here?
I just strongly believe, as far as the Latino community, that we have to look at we have to look at our history and where we came from, and the millennials need to, the young people now, the 20s and 30 year old, were not necessarily those who were born here. Their parents are still here. The history is very young. The Latino community got started in the 1950s, so there's still a lot of people here who came. And they, if it wasn't for the Latino community in two cases, the state would have, for example, in Central Falls, if the Colombian community hadn't come in and saved the mills, the mill Central Falls would have really not existed the way it does now. They saved the mill. They save jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Providence the same way, and if people stop and realize that it's, you know, Latinos and other immigrants really do contribute strongly, and they, if it wasn't for the hard work that they put into what they do, that the state wouldn't be where it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have any impressions regarding just demographics, whether it's economic stancing, where, what are we seeing, the development of kind of a vibrant Latino middle class? Are we seeing more poverty than we see in other demographics? Anything around those lines?
I think I've been in Rhode Island. I wasn't born here, but I've been here for just 30 plus years, and I sometimes look at the Latino community and I feel like nothing's changed.
Mm-hmm.
When I first got here and I started working, I was working in a broad range of topics. I was working for a social service organization, and there were problems, and we were talking about issues with education and housing and health care and jobs, and when I look at what we're still talking about, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And I've been invited to sit on many groups to write reports with a, whether it's from the state level or local level or whatever level. And a lot of those reports were written and they were put in drawers, and I have many copies, and sometimes I'll pull those reports out that were written 20 years ago. And when I read them, I feel like I'm reading them about things that are happening today. Things haven't changed.
Right.
There's always, you know, the cycle where you think things are getting better, the community's growing, and maybe the middle class is getting better, but it just doesn't seem to be that way. And I think a lot of it has to do with not only Latinos, but many people don't feel that Rhode Island has much to offer to them. They move, they leave.
Mm-hmm.
They come here, they raise, they have their kids, they have families, their kids are the ones who leave to look for other opportunities. So it's not just Latinos. I just think that the issues just keep kind of rehashing themselves.
Are there any health trends that, I mean, for example, I know in African-American communities there's high prevalence of asthma, diabetes, and underdiagnosis of learning or mental issues caused by just under-treatment or exposure to environmental racism is what it's called.
Yeah.
So
I think that's what's happening with the Latino community. Similar, is that there's environmental exposure that families can't afford to live in better housing, so they'll just, you know, they'll rent in apartments and houses that don't have the best environmental. They're hazards, and their kids get sick. You know, there's high lead poisoning. There's high asthma, lung disease, and it's mostly those issues with young kids, and then they really don't understand, and landlords take advantage of that, and they don't, they'll rent to immigrants and Latinos.
One place that comes to mind is an open-air junkyard on Allen's Avenue adjacent to a South Providence neighborhood that has metal particulate blowing off the scrap piles into the air.
Yeah.
And they've had years to make it get cleaned up, and it's just been a stop, you know,
right.
It's happened.
Yeah, that's right. The wind blows, it comes in from the ocean air, just blows it right up. Yeah. Yeah, that neighborhood is just subject to a lot of those kinds of issues. Yeah. And we see a lot of immigrants without really even knowing it, just swimming in a lot of the water that we wouldn't ourselves be found swimming in.
Yeah. I mean, there's fishing down at Salters Grove, and, you know, I'm not personally a Salters Grove fisherman.
Yeah, and when you go down there, there's a lot of immigrants. They don't know any better.
Yeah.
A lot of Asians, a lot of Latinos that go down there to fish. The same thing goes with Goddard Park.
Mm-hmm.
That park is, and I believe that there's some really environmental issues going on there, and that's the favorite part of the Latino community, is
yeah.
that swimming.
So, like, bilingual signage might be a major thing that needs
yeah,
to be worked on.
Yeah, and I think education, you know,
mm-hmm.
learning, you know, there's got to be a way to do that, and there's a lot of agencies that can do it the right way. You can't just say, you know, all you people have to do this and do that. I think there's got to be education to learn that you have to care about your environment. I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
that's what happens. If you don't care about it, that's what the first thing that goes wrong is. You can't always depend on government to help you or to fix things for you. You have to, and it has to do with education through local
yeah.
organizations.
Right.
Yeah.
So, in general, it seems like based on this growth of the Latino demographic that America is going to become a bilingual or even more than that, multilingual society within the next 50 years. And there's a lot of people who are being dragged, kicking, and screaming. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it already is. I mean, when you look at, I always enjoy watching some of the commercials that are just very regular. It has nothing to do with politics or what, that are now bilingual.
Okay.
Or you'll even see little things, subtle things in the background or on the table that are Spanish or bilingual. And,
right.
And that's slowly happening. Or people talking in
mm-hmm.
Spanish and answering in English. I think that's a way of us understanding that it's already happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what jumps to my mind is a comparison to, like, Quebec or Montreal, where you see all the street signs are bilingual, or even in certain parts, it's all French language.
Yeah.
With the municipal signs that are produced.
Right, yeah. And like, just yesterday I was somewhere and I noticed a lot of Spanish up in Massachusetts. So people are understanding, government or local groups are understanding that you really do need to have bilingual
mm-hmm.
signs. And Latinos are still coming. They're young to this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
They're young enough so that you have to do that. You have to have bilingual signs. Young meaning not in age, but in their time in the U.S.
Right.
And that's a good way to handle it, just to make sure that the signage and the information is bilingual, so that those who don't speak English well get it, and then
right.
take it from there.
But are there any other points you want to bring up in closing?
No, I just think that the U.S. is a Latino country. It is.
Mm-hmm.
We are the largest country, and people keep saying, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, but I think it's happening now. Latinos
right.
have in Rhode Island. It took a long time for us to get a Spanish-speaking mayor, a Latino mayor, and now a second one. And then in Central Falls it happened as well. But it was an important move to show that we do have, you know, we're at that level in time where we are leaders.
Right.
And in the case of two of the cities, they're young. They're not necessarily 50 and 60 year old men. They're young men,
right?
And they represent that young millennial group of voters that we need to pay attention to.
Antoinette Gomes is director of the Rhode Island College Unity Center, a multicultural affairs department. Its mission is to promote accessibility of educational services and the opportunity for excellence to all students through collaborative programming among its student affiliates, faculty, staff, and the wider community.
So, Antoinette, you work with a lot of students in a public education setting. What are you seeing a lot of students talking about this fall in regards to the election?
I hear a lot of talk about the personalities of the two candidates and this sort of feeling that not being able to trust either candidate. So I guess a feeling of mistrust.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's of the candidates specifically or of the process in general, probably both.
Right. And in terms of what has been a lot of xenophobia and racism expressed out of the ordinary even this year, has there been a great deal of reaction or emotion expressed because of it?
I'm going to ask you to repeat that question.
So have students been getting very upset by the amount of xenophobia, racism, and nativism mm-hmm. that's been coming out over the last 6 to 12 months from Trump?
Yeah, I think it is upsetting, but how it upsets individuals, I won't really speak to that. I can talk about some of the commentary that I hear from the youth that I work with. So comments like, this is the worst I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I really feel like helpless, hopeless even. I've heard both of those things.
All right.
And then, you know, and so some people, so that's, you know, an expression of being upset. You know, but there's also commentary about wanting to be okay with the fact that you are fearing people from other countries because of what's been happening around, you know, so there's some expressions of Islamophobia specifically.
So we are also seeing simultaneous with this election this year, the resurgence of a Black civil rights movement that's has a militancy we haven't seen in a very long time around the movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter. And I was just curious what your reactions were as a parent to seeing this sort of demonstrations being so prominent in the Providence area, whether it gives you hope, whether it makes you cautious. What do you feel about that?
Well, I am going to speak decidedly from my parental perspective. And I will say that my feelings and thoughts, I think, probably span the entire spectrum of feelings and thoughts. So I have to say that in terms of the militancy, you know, I mean, you characterize it as this militancy that we haven't seen in recent times, but I have seen this militancy as an African-American person for a while. I just think that now that it's very mainstream due to, you know, social media and other kinds of technologies, that white folks are seeing it more. But the militancy has always been there. It's been there as long as these sort of disparate social occurrences have been. So, you know, as long as Black folks have been treated poorly by institutions across the country, then the militancy has been there. It probably just hasn't been as visible or as audible, right? Mm-hmm. So, parentally, I'm like, one side of me says, well, good, because people need to understand the fear, the pain, the mistrust, the lack of education around these issues. Everyone needs to understand that that is happening. And while it is happening indirectly or directly in your life, it is still happening. So in that regard, I'm thinking, well, good for people like my children who are younger and have really been driving this quote unquote militancy. Good for them. On the other hand, you know, militancy often has a bad connotation.
Right, and I apologize for using that word in particular.
Please don't. You got to be able to speak, Andrew. That's what we're doing right now.
Right.
I think that, you know, sometimes, though, people hear that word militancy and they think, oh, my goodness, oh, my gosh, I should be afraid. And I'm like, no, you shouldn't be afraid. You should be thinking, why are they using that word? What does this word mean? And I think so please do not apologize for using it.
I understand.
So I think that, you know, again, as a parent, I'm somewhat encouraged that I think that there's a raising of the social consciousness. And on the other hand, I'm like, oh, it scares me to raise the social consciousness because there are always those who will be offended, and sometimes those people have the power to act upon their feelings of offensiveness. So, yeah, I can't say, oh, I'm feeling this way or that way, because it depends on what's happening locally, what's happening nationally, what's happening globally, what's happening to me. So it depends. It's very sort of fluid.
Yeah, right. And in general, do you see things moving in a direction in terms of just the propulsion that the local movement has been generating that seems like it could bring the black and brown community to a place that was inconceivable perhaps, say, 8 years ago?
Do I think that what's happening locally might be able to elevate the black and brown community to a place that was inconceivable?
Yes, or it didn't seem like that discourse was at that level before.
Yeah, you know, I can't, I'm not going to lie, I can't say that I'm like, oh, well, this is great because I really see that this change is coming down the pike, and so, you know, all of this protest and outspokenness is really, you know, very positive, making a big positive difference. I don't think that I'm there yet because it's wonderful for black and brown folks to have this conversation, but until everybody's engaged in the conversation, everybody, black, brown, white, red, whatever, and poor, business owners, laborers, so politicians, until everybody feels like they are stakeholders in, you know, our social outcomes. I don't see a lot of change happening, just a lot of more cyclical stuff.
Gotcha. So speaking from the position you do occupy in a public education institution, what are some concerns about education and the ability to get access to higher education that people really should be talking about the day after the election?
Cost? I mean, yeah, they should be talking about cost because, you know, most people can be educated. Most people, but a lot of people want to be educated. So I think that there's a couple things that should definitely be in the national discourse. One of them is the cost of public education. I think public education should be strong, and it should be available to folks who want to utilize it. Private education, well, it's private, so there's less public influence over private matters, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I personally think that all education would be free for those who seek it would be nice. But I don't think that that's feasible in this capitalist country. But for public education, the costs need to be low. They need to be low enough that they don't widen gaps along identifiable measures like race and income and zip code, you know? So I think cost is one issue. I also think that, quite frankly, the way education is perceived needs to be completely and utterly rethought, because everybody doesn't need a 4-year liberal arts. And I mean, I'm a liberal arts person. I like liberal arts. But it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody. We need to start valuing different kinds of education, different disciplines. We need to start valuing it and understanding that it's a good thing to look at it differently, because then our education system can kind of keep up with the evolution of our technology, our demographics, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Thank you for listening today, and please tune in for other episodes of this series as they are released by the Rhode Island Media Cooperative. You can follow along through our Facebook page or on Twitter via @RIMediaCoop.